Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, scientists say we still have time to address climate change, and we've made headway, but we still have a long way to go. We speak with renowned climate scientist Michael Mann. But first, Chauncey Bailey was the first journalist in the U.S. to be killed for doing his job since the 1970s. We'll explore the reasons behind his assassination. On an August morning in 2007, Chauncey Bailey, a longtime reporter in Oakland, was gunned down for a story he was working on. It was the first time a journalist had been killed in the U.S. for doing his job since the 1970s. Why would someone target Chauncey Bailey? We have with us Thomas Peel. He's the author of Killing the Messenger, a story of radical faith, racism's backlash, and the assassination of a journalist. Welcome, Thomas Peel.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's great to have you with us. Chauncey Bailey, he was the first journalist to be killed in the U.S. for doing his job since, what, 1973, I think you said?
1976.
So let's start with the journalist himself, Chauncey Bailey. It didn't seem like he was doing intense investigative journalism.
No, he wasn't. Chauncey was, in his heart, a community reporter. He found and saw stories everywhere. He was incredibly productive. He didn't do in-depth investigative work, but in Detroit and in Oakland, he covered minority communities in the cliche of kind of like a blanket. He was out in the community. He was a master at writing multiple short daily newspaper stories a day when he worked for daily newspapers, and he was the kind of reporter that really carried newspapers. You know, when newspapers used to be flush, you know, for those of us who can remember that, sometimes editors' problems weren't having enough news, they were having too much news, or having too much space in the newspaper and needing to fill it. And that's what Chauncey was really good at. He was good at, as one editor told me for the book, you know, getting a story, getting it down, getting it in, moving on to the next story. Who he was as a reporter.
And it seemed, particularly from your portrayal of him and about what his ultimate death uncovered, that he was really wanting to support his community. He was African-American himself, really wanted to see African-Americans succeed.
He did. He would write stories about people trying to start businesses and give them a little bit of a boost. He was empathetic to people who were trying to make it because he seemed in his life to always be trying to make it himself. And he ended up as editor of the Oakland Post, which is a small free circulation tabloid, sometimes only 8 pages once a week.
So it seems sort of bizarre in the juxtaposition of him then being targeted for assassination by an organization that was also an African-American group.
Let's take the juxtaposition first. It's ironic that somebody who was as supportive of his fellow African-Americans as Chauncey would end up dead at the hands of a leader of a supposed African-American empowerment organization. But the people who were responsible for Chauncey's death kind of hid behind that image, particularly the young man who ordered his assassination, a young man named Yusuf Bey IV. He was good at propping up this image that his organization only existed to help people, but in fact, the only person that he wanted to help was himself. And he also had a very rigid view of the world in that he saw people who were not with him completely as being against him. And that is how he saw Chauncey when Chauncey started working on a story about his organization, which, you know, we all know was known as your Black Muslim Bakery.
Yusuf Bey, let's talk about him and how this organization sprang up. Give us the backdrop of that.
Yusuf Bey, I will refer to him going forward now as Bey the Elder. He was the patriarch of this organization, and I like to say that he had a little George Foreman in him and that he named 5 sons after himself. He was a hairdresser, of all things, and he and his brother, their last name was Stevens, before they converted to becoming Black Muslims, they ran a hair salon in Santa Barbara, California, in the early 1960s. At one point, they decided to go to Los Angeles to check out the Black Muslims. And the Black Muslims were in the news a lot in Los Angeles because they had had a horrible encounter with the Los Angeles Police Department. Several members of a mosque there had been shot. There had been some brutalizations. Some people who were the subject of police abuses were, in fact, charged with assaulting police. History has borne out that police were really the aggressor in this horrible situation because they were very fearful of the black Muslims. And eventually, Malcolm X came out from New York when he was still a member of the Nation of Islam, and he was leading a bit of a revolt against the Los Angeles Police Department. It made a lot of news, and eventually that made its way up to Santa Barbara, and the Stevens brothers got interested, and they went down to Los Angeles, and they eventually converted to become members of the Nation of Islam. They won permission from Elijah Muhammad to open a small mosque in Santa Barbara. Bay the Elder, then still going by the name Joseph X. Stevens, was the mosque secretary, second in command, and his brother Billy X. Stevens was the minister. In August of 1968, two members of that mosque were shot dead in Santa Barbara, a husband and wife who were shot dead in their bed in the middle of the night. No one was ever charged with their killing, but it's very apparent from reading police reports that the Stevens brothers were somehow involved in the murder, either enabling it or one of them pulling the trigger himself. It just didn't add up their stories to the police. And it turns out that the man who was killed had complained to Elijah Muhammad in Chicago that the Stevens brothers were making him commit fraud crimes. In fact, he was twice ordered to steal Cadillacs belonging to their mother, drive them down into Ventura County, and torch them for the insurance money. He complained about that, being forced to do that, and that's how he was dealt with. He was shot dead. Eventually, after several months of very intense police scrutiny, Stevens brothers closed shop in Santa Barbara and they moved to Oakland. They had been raised in Oakland as young men. They'd been born in Texas, but their parents came west at the start of World War II. Their father was a shipyard worker, found employment in California after President Roosevelt desegregated the naval shipyards in the Bay Area for the war effort. So they came back to Oakland in early 1969 after these murders, and they eventually opened a Nation of Islam mosque in Oakland. But it was a little bizarre because it wasn't independent. They were under another minister in San Francisco. That led to a lot of bad situations back and forth between Oakland and San Francisco. And eventually there was a three-way split. San Francisco went its own way with its own mosque with no control over Oakland. Bay the Elder's brother, Billy, became the Nation of Islam minister in Oakland. And Bay the Elder broke off in the Nation of Islam entirely in the early 1970s. And his position was he wanted to run his own business and not have to contribute money to Chicago. But he continued to practice the same belief system as Farad, who was the person that the black Muslims worshipped as God. And he as Allah. And that was who Bay continued to worship, but he was separate from the Nation of Islam. I kind of liken it to, in terms of, say, a Baptist minister leaving a National Baptist organization but still worshiping Jesus, but doing it independently.
This was quite different from other Muslim organizations. The philosophy was quite different. It has a supremacist aspect to it. Can you give us a sense of the organization?
The belief system began in Detroit in 1930, when Mr. Farad, who had been in prison in California on a drug charge, showed up in Detroit selling silks and raincoats in the ghetto. That was kind of his shtick, and he was a natural salesman. And he would work door-to-door with people, and he would eventually start telling folks that he had come to save them, that he was a savior, and that he had come from Mecca. And he was telling people who had come north in the Great Migration, these descendants of slaves, that everything they knew to be true was false, and that their native religion in Africa was not Christianity. It was Islam. But it was Farad's version of Islam. It was not Islam as taught by the Prophet Muhammad and worshipped by billions of people around the world. It wasn't even close. Farad insisted that he was God in the flesh, which we know is blasphemy to an Orthodox Muslim. He insisted that there was a spaceship orbiting the earth that only he and his followers could see, and that it was always preparing to launch bombers that would start Armageddon. He insisted that people of color were the world's master race, and that they had been the world's master race until 6,600 years earlier, when a mad scientist performed a series of grafting experiments and made the devil, who he said were Caucasians and Jews. It was a very bizarre story that he foisted on very ignorant people. But he was also able to drive a wedge in these people's belief system, because he asked them how they could worship the same God that their oppressors worshipped and used to justify their oppression. And that was something that got people's attention. And he won hundreds of converts in Detroit. And in 1932, his organization became known to authorities after a member of it committed a human sacrifice murder. There were reports, never fully proven, that they were killing people of other races. It became a mess very quickly. But among the people who bought into this rhetoric was a man named Elijah Poole, who the world now knows as Elijah Muhammad. And while Farad disappeared by 1934, Elijah Muhammad had become his chief disciple and spent the next 40 years of his life preaching Farad's belief system to people. And that's eventually how Bey the Elder came to believe in it.
So Bey
became a disciple of Elijah Muhammad.
So Yusuf Bey the Elder, he's got this bakery which is employing a lot of African Americans who would have been either in prison or at risk. So he's really, in a way, providing something very important to that community. But at the
same, he was providing jobs to very poor people. When he started this in the early 70s, there were not a lot of employers in the Oakland ghettos. For sure. I mean, this was almost unheard of that an entrepreneur would come in and open something like a commercial bakery. And by 1973, he had so many retail demands for his baked goods that he was running 24 hours a day. And he had a midnight shift of people to come in to bake bread. This was really a very rare event that there were this type of job opportunities in the Oakland Flats in the early 1970s.
And then at the same time, you implied that there's all of this racket going on in the background. So by the time he dies of cancer, he's being charged with rape, some 27 counts of rape, and a host of other accusations. But before then, nobody would ever look into this.
No, he managed to build shrouds around himself and this organization. He was able to prop himself up with this idea that he alone could save poor people. And while he did offer them jobs, those jobs came with a great deal of attachments. People had to convert to his belief system. Men had to be willing to commit violence against others at the snap of his finger. And women, he preached, had to learn to submit to him completely. He was, in his heart, a polygamist cult leader, because that's really what this organization became. It was a polygamist cult. At any given time, there were a dozen or more women within his compound who considered themselves to be his plural wives. He fathered more than 40 children, probably a lot more. We can document like 43 or 44 of them by various women, some of whom bore his children when they were as young as 13. He was a child rapist. He was a very, very vociferous sexual predator.
They never did manage to convict him because he died first, right?
Right. He died of AIDS in 2003 after being charged in 2002 with these crimes, and his defense was to drag it out. And he knew he was going to die. He did not want that conviction on his record when it happened. And he eventually got so sick he couldn't go to court, and the case ended with his death. And it allowed his followers, who believed in him very much, believed in him as a godlike figure, to say that he'd never been convicted of anything, that it was simply the system and specifically white people out to destroy him.
So then let's connect this back to Chauncey Bailey, the journalist,
sure,
who had been covering the bakery and the Bey family, but really was not digging that deeply. Why was he targeted? Why was he assassinated?
After Bey died, there was a bloody feud within the organization for the right of succession. Bey's first appointed successor was dead within a matter of months. one of his young sons, Antar Bey, took over the organization. He borrowed a great deal of money from a finance company saying he was going to expand the bakery, was going to open another bakery in Los Angeles. In less than 2 years, he was dead, and it turns out that his youngest brother, Yusuf Bey IV, ordered that killing. So in 2005, 19-year-old Yusuf Bey IV, again, one of the many sons that Bey the Elder named after himself, was now in charge of the bakery and various criminal enterprises that supported it. And he was very much his father's son. He spoke very openly about creating the same type of polygamist organization that had flourished for years under his father. 19 years old, he had no idea how to run a business. He stopped paying taxes to the IRS. He stopped paying back the very large loans that his brother Antar had taken out with the bakery as collateral. And less than a year after he got control of the organization, he was forced to file for bankruptcy protection. He couldn't come up with a plan to satisfy the judge that he could reorganize the business and satisfy his debts, and that bankruptcy protection moved into a case where the bakery was going to be liquidated. Chauncey had covered the bakery on and off for years. He'd written about it for the Oakland Tribune. He'd covered many of Bey the Elder's court appearances in that sex case, and he was tipped off in July of 2007 that he should look into the bankruptcy proceeding with the bakery. And he was doing that and working on a story about Yusuf Bey IV for the Oakland Post, the little weekly paper that he was now editor of, in the weeks before he was killed.
The television station that Chauncey Bailey worked for would not run any of the material, but the newspaper did.
Well, the newspaper ran his stories about Bey the Elder's sex case, which was big news in Oakland because here was this supposedly pious minister and politician who is now charged with raping 13-year-old girls. It was a sensational story. Chauncey covered that for the Oakland Tribune, but he also worked as the news director of a small independent television station in Oakland that was on cable, a station called Soulbeat. And it happened that Bey the Elder had a show on Soulbeat in which he gave a weekly sermon, and he paid for that. It was paid advertising to the bakery. So Bey the Elder told the station owner that if Chauncey Bailey's newscast included anything about this sex case and these rape allegations, that he was going to cancel his paid advertising. And the station owner prohibited Chauncey from reporting anything to do with the sex case. It was a very untenable situation. And it again gave Bey this sense of power that was eventually transferred to his son. So when young Yusuf Bey IV in the summer of 2007 found out that Chauncey Bailey was going to be writing about this bankruptcy case, he was absolutely livid about it and believed that he should not be the subject of such journalistic scrutiny.
So the latest story didn't even run in the newspaper.
No, Chauncey was working on a story. He'd had a source of someone who had been in the organization, who believed that Bey IV was the illegitimate leader of it and was hoping that the bakery could emerge from the bankruptcy proceedings with a different leadership in place. It was not something that was going to happen given the amount of debt that it had, but it's what they wanted, what this other man named Salim Bey, who had been married to one of Bey the Elder's daughters, wanted. And he was trying to get Chauncey to write about the bankruptcy proceeding because he thought that might further his ends.
It just seems so dramatic to assassinate a reporter who hasn't even written a particularly negative story.
It was a story straight up out of the bankruptcy proceeding. It's a public proceeding. It had, in fact, been reported in local business journals that report every bankruptcy filing. It wasn't a secret. And that's one of the most ironic things about it. What Chauncey was reporting on wasn't a secret. But he had written a story. The publisher of the Oakland Post, a man named Paul Cobb, had rejected at first publishing it. He claimed there wasn't enough attribution in it, kind of thought that Mr. Cobb had been around Oakland long enough to know that the Bays were dangerous, and he was being very cautious about running even a fairly innocuous story about them. Chauncey very much wanted to get that story into the newspaper, though. That's who he was.
In the end, Bey IV, you call him the fourth throughout the book,
right,
did end up going to prison.
He did, because he decided that the best way to deal with Chauncey Bailey writing a story about this bankruptcy proceeding was to send out two of his young minions, a kid named Devondre Brassard, who was 19, another fellow named Antoine Mackey, who was 21. He would send them out to find Chauncey Bailey and shoot him dead. And on the morning of August 2nd, 2007, that's exactly what they did. They found Chauncey walking to work. Brassard was dressed in all black with a ski mask over his head, and he ran up to Chauncey in downtown Oakland, two blocks from Chauncey's office, and got right up on top of him with this little pistol-grip 12-gauge shotgun, and he shot him three times, and Chauncey was dead on the sidewalk in a matter of seconds.
Now, by this point, the authorities, who had been steering clear of the entire Bay operation, were no longer steering clear.
That is correct. This wasn't the first crime, this ordering of Chauncey Bailey, the journalist killed, that Yusuf Bey IV had committed in 2007. He had ordered, ironically enough, two other men killed a month earlier. He was also the mastermind of a bizarre kidnapping and torture plot of a woman to try to learn where a local drug dealer stashed money and cocaine. And he was under police investigation. This was a change in Oakland because the Oakland Police Department for years had had a policy of not engaging the Bays. They were kind of left alone. They were left alone to police their neighborhood in North Oakland, and they were left alone to kind of fend for themselves. But the police could not ignore two murders, and they could not ignore the kidnapping and torture of this woman that was very bizarre and brazen, and also was broken up incredibly by a police officer who literally stumbled on the scene and saved this poor woman's life. So the police were coming for these guys. And on August 1st, the day before Chauncey was killed, they had scheduled a massive raid of the Bay compound involving 200 SWAT cops, biggest operation in the history of the Oakland Police Department. But then at the last minute, it was postponed for 2 days because several SWAT commanders were on vacation and the police chief didn't want to proceed without them being back and being the leaders of the operation. So suddenly there was this 48-hour window, and it was during that 48-hour window that Brassard and Mackey tracked down Mr. Bailey and killed him. Then on the morning of August 3rd, the delayed raid took place. Yusuf Bey IV was arrested. Devondre Brassard was arrested. Brassard was seen throwing the murder weapon out a window. He was taken into custody and pursued as the lead suspect in Mr. Bailey's murder. Yusuf Bey IV was charged in the kidnapping and torture case that I just mentioned.
Well, Thomas Peel, Killing the Messenger, A Story of Radical Faith, Racism's Backlash, and the Assassination of a Journalist. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome, Maria. Thank you for having me.
When we come back, we speak with renowned climate scientist Michael Mann. Stay tuned. You are listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Our next guest is a renowned climate scientist who can tell us both about the science and the policies. He's also lived the rough and tumble life of politics and wrote about it in his new book, The Madhouse Effect. Dr. Michael Mann hasn't lost hope that we can still address climate change before it's too late, though he acknowledges that the changes have already begun. Professor Michael Mann is a climatologist and geophysicist, and he's the director of the Earth System Science Center at Pennsylvania State University. Dr. Mann was one of the lead authors of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, and has written a book called The Madhouse Effect. Welcome to the Scholar's Circle, Dr. Michael Mann. It's great to have you back here with us again.
Thanks. It's great to be back with you.
You have this new book to address the general public, but you have also done a lot of the climate science yourself. I wanted to talk first about this address that you gave recently. You had said that the tools that you and other climate scientists had developed are increasingly unnecessary, maybe because we can actually see the real effects of climate change now. There are two big questions that come out of that. First of all, how would you describe the effects that we can actually see right now?
So that was a comment I made actually at a hearing of the Democratic National Committee related to the Democratic platform, and I had been asked to talk to the committee about the science of climate change. And the point I was making was sort of, it was really almost a rhetorical point, and unfortunately there's some of my detractors really went out of their way to take it out of context to make it sound like I was saying that we no longer need data and models to do science. And that's not at all what I was saying. What I was saying was when it comes to actually seeing the impacts of climate change, the impacts are no longer subtle, and it's no longer necessary to try to tease the signal out of the noise of natural climate variability in the way we would have had to do in the past, because the signal has become so large that we can actually see it with our very own two eyes. An example being the flooding in Louisiana. That was a record flooding event, and we know that the fact that there was so much rainfall was tied to the fact that there was a very large amount of moisture in the atmosphere, and that was tied to the very warm ocean temperatures. The Gulf of Mexico sea surface temperatures as high as they've ever been. The last year, of course, has been a record year where the oceans have been warmer than they've ever been before. And so what that means is that warmer oceans evaporate more moisture into the atmosphere. There's more moisture available to turn into record rainfall events. And so the fact that we've seen, I think, a half dozen thousand-year rainfall events, and what do we mean? When we say a thousand-year rainfall event, we mean, based on the normal statistics of weather, that event shouldn't happen more often than once in a thousand years. And just over the last year, we probably had about a half dozen of those thousand-year rainfall events, not just Louisiana, but Texas, in Arizona, in South Carolina, in West Virginia. And so what we're seeing in these very large increase in the number of extreme weather events, we're seeing the loading of the weather dice. We're seeing the sort of random dice of weather have been loaded by climate change towards these more extreme events. And, you know, that flooding is just part of it. We've seen record wildfires and unprecedented drought in California. We are seeing the impacts of climate change play out now in real time.
As I had understood this just from reading the layperson literature, is that you can't really identify one or two of these events and say, well, this is definitely a result of climate change, but collectively they are related to climate change.
It's somewhere in between the two statements, really. That's partly true, but it's not the whole story. And in fact, in our new book, in The Madhouse Effect, Tom Tolles and I include a cartoon that actually deals with this question of, you know, whether you can or not you can blame extreme weather events on climate change. And there's a little footnote in the cartoon, as there always are in Tom's cartoons. Many of your listeners will be familiar with his cartoons on the pages of the Washington Post, the square cartoons. And there's a little guy down in the corner, which is actually Tom himself, who's usually saying something pithy, something you want to read, the small print. And in the small print of that one, it's a loophole you could lose a planet through. And what we mean there is it's sort of a loophole to be able to say, well, you know, you can never blame any one weather event on climate change. It's tantamount to saying you can never blame any one death from lung cancer on smoking of cigarettes. Even though we know many people died from lung cancer because they smoked cigarettes, it could have happened naturally. So if you're talking about any one individual, there's always the possibility that it could have happened naturally. And in fact, that gave rise to a concept called fractional attribution, which is now used in climate change as well. It was used in the legal settlements with the tobacco industry that, you know, basically that some percentage of people who died of from lung cancer we know was caused by your product, and you have a liability that's associated with that. So even though it's a statistical connection, real people, actual people did die from lung cancer caused by smoking cigarettes, and actual weather events have been made worse in many different ways by the effects of climate change. And so when somebody says something like, well, you can't prove it was caused by climate change, It really is. It's a technicality. It's also like, I always like to use sports analogies in professional baseball. Barry Bonds, of course, broke the record for home runs, I think, one season, and then it was found that he had been taking steroids and that the record was invalidated. And, you know, his defense might be, for any one home run that I hit that season, you can't prove that that home run was caused by the steroid use. And that may be technically true, but it's still a loophole. And so that's sort of the analogy.
One of the things that seemed interesting to me over all of this is that the changes seem to have happened much faster than we were originally thinking they would happen. Is that true?
In many respects, it is true. And it really gets at a very important point. You know, the critics, those who favor an agenda of inaction, of not doing anything about the problem, will say, well, there's uncertainty in the science. And as long as there's uncertainty, we don't know for sure that, you know, the burning of fossil fuels is a problem, so we shouldn't take action. Well, that's not true. But even the very premise behind that sort of reasoning is wrong, because uncertainty cuts both ways. And yeah, maybe you can get lucky, and the uncertainties might cut in the direction of some of the impacts not being as bad as we predicted. But the history of the science seems to suggest the other possibility. In many respects, the changes have taken place faster than we predicted. The uncertainty appears to be cutting against us, not in our favor when it comes to the impacts of climate change. And that's true with the loss of Arctic sea ice. We're losing Arctic sea ice. The Arctic is sort of our refrigerator. And as we lose that sea ice, that impacts the entire planet in an adverse way. And the models have tended to predict that we shouldn't see the disappearance of sea ice in the late summer. We just, by the way, tied the second lowest sea ice level at the end of this summer. And so we're near record lows, and we're already well outside of the range of what the models predicted. The models predicted we shouldn't see a total disappearance of Arctic sea ice until the end of this century. If you extrapolate the trajectory we're on, scientists expect that within maybe a decade or two, we will see ice-free conditions in the Arctic. We also know that the ice sheets, the continental ice sheets, the Greenland ice sheet, the West Antarctic ice sheet, losing ice well ahead of schedule. The models predicted that they shouldn't start, those ice sheets shouldn't start to disintegrate until the middle of this century. And in part, that's because some of the models actually have more snow accumulation taking place in the center of the ice sheet, where the atmosphere is actually slightly warmer. There's more moisture, so you get more snowfall in the interior of the ice sheet, and that offsets the melting that's taking place at the periphery of the ice sheet, where it meets the ocean, for example. Well, it turns out that that's not what's happening. We are losing ice at the periphery much faster than there's any replacement in the center of the ice sheets, and so we're losing ice from the continental ice sheets decades ahead of schedule. That means that we are seeing an increase in sea level rise from the melting of that ice that, again, is well ahead of schedule. So the sea level rise problem is worse than we expected based on the predictions that were made, you know, just a decade ago. And there are many other examples where the changes and the impacts are playing out faster and worse than what we had predicted.
I imagine that the ecosystems themselves, both in the oceans and of land, are the most severely affected, which then has the ongoing influence on our food and water and that sort of a thing. Can you just give us a thumbnail sketch of what we've seen so far?
That's absolutely right. And one of the problems is that when you start looking at impacts on, you know, ecosystems, on species, on food webs, there's something, you know, a term we use in science, nonlinear. It means that there are very complex interactions between, you know, living things and each other and their environment. And there's the potential that a small change in the external conditions can lead to a very large change in the behavior of that system. Tipping points, collapse. You can have the collapse of ecosystems where a small change in climate upsets the balance such that you really get a far more abrupt and profound impact on the environment, on species, animal species. Coral reefs is a very good example. They are under threat right now from multiple insults caused by human activity. climate change being one of them, warming of oceans, coral bleaching imperils coral reefs, but the increasing CO2 in the atmosphere is making the oceans more acid, and that's literally starting to dissolve the coral reefs. And then you add the pollutions, the pollutants that make it out into our oceans, and they're being hit by all these simultaneous insults. And again, it's the so-called non-linearity. When you have a system, when you have a living thing, and we know this in our own lives, you know, when one bad thing happens to you, you can deal with it. When a couple bad things happen to you, you know, it's a little hard to deal with. When three or four different things start going badly in your life, all of a sudden you feel like your entire world is collapsing, and that's because we react poorly, and all living things react poorly to multiple simultaneous insults, and that's what we're doing to our ecosystems right now, and it's a cause for worry. We are subjecting them to changes that they have not experienced in the entire history of their existence, and we're doing that in multiple ways. We're hitting them with multiple insults.
One of the things that you addressed in this new book of yours is your detractors, as you called them here, and they had been very vocal historically with the denial and the argument that there wasn't enough certainty in the science to move policy forward. It seems like, though, they have been quieter lately. Would you say that's true, or is that just perception because of the media I follow?
Yeah, no, it's an interesting insight, and I think that is true to some extent. I think that climate change denialism is becoming somewhat marginalized, at least in our mainstream public discourse. Now, there's some important provisos there. You know, climate change denial is still expressed at the very highest levels of our politics right now. But I do think that climate change denial is less welcome in polite conversation now, and I think that's in part due to, you know, something that we started out talking about at the beginning of this interview. People can see that something's happening. It's no longer subtle. The impacts of climate change are no longer subtle. When people can start to see that something happening with their own two eyes, it makes it very difficult for you to tell them that it's not happening. And I think that's really one of the critical developments here, that the profound nature of the impacts of climate change is such that it just makes it not credible anymore to deny that something is happening.
So in the book, in this new book of yours, you said that we can still avoid the catastrophes, maybe even reverse some of it. Do you think that's true?
Yeah. You know, the reality is that there is no one threshold. I can't give you a precise amount of warming of the globe and promise you that if we keep warming below that, bad things won't happen. Let's, you know, face it. There are some bad things that we already see happening just from the climate change that's already taken place. So it's a matter of how far we're willing to go down this dangerous road. And, you know, the experts who have looked at the impacts of climate change have determined that once you go beyond about 2 degrees Celsius warming of the planet relative to the pre-industrial time, that's 3.5 Fahrenheit warming, and we're already about halfway there. We've already warmed the planet a degree Celsius. We maybe have another half a degree Celsius in the pipeline, and so we only have a small amount of wiggle room if we're going to avoid crossing that dangerous 2 degrees Celsius limit. We can still do it. If you just look at the numbers, if you crunch the math, it is possible for us to bring our emissions down at a rate of several percent a year in the decades ahead, such that we avoid crossing that sort of 2 degrees Celsius warming range where we really do start to see the worst impacts of climate change. So if we act now, we can avert a catastrophe, and we are seeing some progress already due to the amazing sort of developments in renewable energy technology, the dramatic increases in the market share of renewable energy, and even here in the U.S., where we have seen a dramatic increase in wind and solar power, in electric vehicles. We're starting to turn the corner. Last year, the numbers came in and told us that carbon emissions, for the first time on record globally, actually went down. And that's a direct response to the efforts, you know, among many of the nations of the world to try to stem the tide and do something about the problem and transition towards renewable energy. So we're starting to turn the corner. The problem is we need to turn the corner even faster if we are going to avoid crossing that dangerous threshold of warming. And so we got an important start in the process in Paris, where nearly 200 nations around the world, including the world's top emitters of carbon, agreed to make substantial reductions, enough to cut the warming roughly in half from where we would be going under business as usual emissions, basically getting us halfway to what we need to do to keep the warming below 2 degrees Celsius. So we're starting to go down the right path, but we're going to have to do a lot more if we're going to avert catastrophic impacts on our planet.
Is there any way for you to be able to explain, like in specific terms, like how much would we need to do, change our energy by X percent, or change our driving habits by Y percent, or anything like that, or our eating habits?
Yeah, so I mean, there are a lot of things that we can do on a voluntary basis that cut our carbon emissions, decreases our personal carbon footprint, and we ought to be doing them anyways, because what we call no regrets actions, like bicycling to work when we can rather than driving to work, well, it saves us money. It makes us healthier. More efficient appliances saves us money as well. There are all these things that we can do that cut our carbon emissions and make us healthier and happier and save us money, and we ought to be doing those things anyways. In fact, we call them negative costs, because actually there's a benefit immediately to doing it. But that doesn't get us as far. Voluntary actions alone don't get us as far as we need to go if we are going to avoid that dangerous level of warming. And so if you talk to economists, they'll tell you that to really solve this problem, we need to put a price on carbon. What that means is when you burn carbon, producers of fossil fuel energy and power have to pay for the damage that their product is doing to our planet through some sort of mechanism. It can be a tax, a carbon tax. It could be some sort of cap and trade system. But one way or another, we need to put a cost on the burning of fossil fuels so we level the energy marketplace, so that renewable energy, which isn't degrading our planet in the same way, can compete fairly against fossil fuel energy, which has this cost that isn't currently, represented in the marketplace. There isn't a price signal right now for the damage that fossil fuel energy is doing to the planet. And until you put a price on the burning of carbon, you really don't have the incentive system necessary to steer us in the direction we need to go. So, many of the experts, economists who have studied this problem, will tell you we need a price on carbon. And if we get a price on carbon, that actually will lead us. It's almost like it's magic. Once you cost the damage through, a mechanism like a carbon tax, then people start changing their behavior in the direction that we need to change our behavior, because it's built into the market.
What I was getting at was getting a sense of how much we need to alter either the energy use or the, I know farming is also another big source of emissions. And so I guess I was trying to get a sense of how much we would need to shift in order to avert going down a disastrous path.
We have to bring our carbon emissions down by about 5% a year over the next several decades if we're going to avoid raising CO2 levels to where we get that 2 degrees Celsius or more warming of the planet. And so we obviously need policies that achieve those sorts of reductions. Now, some of those policy changes are almost invisible to us. If you have a carbon tax, like I said, then all of a sudden, energy producers will increase the percentage of their portfolio that is from renewable sources, from wind, from solar, from geothermal. So, you know, the energy that you're getting comes increasingly from renewable sources. And so we might end up paying a little bit more for energy as we go through that transition. But it really is almost imperceptible, the impact that it actually has on our lives. So some people think that we have to fundamentally change our lifestyles to deal with this problem. That isn't necessarily true. We have existing technology right now that if we scale it up at the rate that we could potentially scale it up, and there are peer-reviewed scientific studies that show this, that we could meet nearly 100% of our projected energy needs from renewable energy, from renewable sources alone, within a matter of a couple of decades. We can do that. We have the technology to do it. We just need the policy incentives to move us in that direction. And to us, in the way that we lead our daily lives, it doesn't necessarily need to lead to any dramatic change in our lifestyles. That having been said, sure, there are things that we can do, changes in our lifestyle, that if we make them voluntarily, they definitely will help out the problem. But no, we do not have to dramatically change our lifestyles to solve this problem. We just need to favor policies that will incentivize the market to move in the direction that it needs to go for us to basically wean ourselves off fossil fuels.
I think you said 5% change is what we would actually need in terms of emissions?
5% reduction a year in the carbon emissions.
Okay.
And right now, I mean, renewable energy is almost growing at a rate that will achieve that as long as we incentivize those renewable energy sources.
So the solar and the wind are growing at a rate that can almost get us there. And so you're thinking perhaps we can meet that 5% by just a little bit of tweaking.
Yeah, let me give you an example. So we sometimes talk about market parity or grid parity. When renewable energy becomes as or less expensive than fossil fuel energy. And right now we're on a trajectory where that will be true probably in a matter of 5 to 10 years. If we did nothing other than just let, you know, the renewable energy providers do what they're doing, we soon enough would be at the point where it would be cheaper to go with renewable energy anyways. Now, the problem is that we don't have 5 to 10 years to wait if we're going to decrease our carbon emissions so that we avoid warming the planet more than 2 degrees Celsius, and that means that you do need extra market incentives that help steer us in the direction that we're starting to go anyway. So it's sort of like you're just sort of accelerating the natural process that's already underway, where we are moving away from fossil fuel energy towards renewable energy. In a matter of years, renewable energy will outcompete fossil fuel energy even without a price on carbon. But we need a price on carbon to get us there even sooner.
When these policy discussions occur, do you still have a sense that the fossil fuel industry are fighting on the other side to prevent the renewable energies from coming online in such a powerful way? Or do you have a sense that they're going to perhaps maybe even buy into the renewable energies in order to stay viable companies?
Yeah, I think the enlightened companies, and we're already seeing that, are going to invest a larger and larger amount of their portfolio in renewable sources. I mean, that is the direction that the global economy is going. China recognizes that. They are outspending us. They are investing far more in renewable energy. They're moving towards, in fact, they have invested so much in solar cell technology that their products have flooded the global market and led to a sharp decrease in the cost of solar panels. So the research and development that they've done has benefited the entire world with cheaper solar panels. So that's the direction that the global economy is headed. And those countries that get on board are going to be out ahead on this. And those countries that continue to rely on fossil fuels for energy are going to fall behind the rest of the world in terms of their global competitiveness. And so, you know, that is the direction that things are going anyways. And if we, you know, don't move in that direction, then we fall behind the rest of the world.
And I can't let you leave our radio program without explaining the hockey stick.
Sure thing. So back in the late 1990s, my co-authors and I engaged in a scientific analysis where we attempted to extend the record of global temperatures back in time, because we only have about a century and a half of widespread thermometer measurements around the globe, and that allows us to construct a curve that shows how temperatures have changed over the last 150 years. And that curve shows that the globe has warmed and it continues to warm. In fact, the last year was the warmest year on record. But what the instrumental data alone can't tell us is how unusual that sort of warming might be in a longer-term context. And so back in the late 1990s, to try to create that longer-term context, we did an analysis where we made use of what we call proxy data, like tree rings and corals and ice cores and sediments, to reconstruct how the climate had changed in the more distant past. And that led to a curve that depicted our estimate of how temperatures had changed over the last 1,000 years. And that curve showed relatively modest changes from 1,000 years ago to the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. In fact, a small drop in temperatures as we headed into what was known as the Little Ice Age of the 17th, 18th, 19th centuries, followed by an unprecedented spike, which is the spike of modern global warming, that takes us outside of the range of the variation that was evident as far back as we could go, 1,000 years. And it sort of looks like a hockey stick, where the blade is the modern warming spike that indeed is unprecedented as far back as we or others have been able to take these sorts of estimates. Because of the appearance of the graph, it got called the hockey stick. It became an icon in the climate change debate, an iconic sort of entity in the climate change debate, because it told a simple story. You didn't need to understand the complex workings of Earth's climate to understand what this curve was telling us, that there is this unprecedented warming of the planet that has taken place over the last century and a half. And by inference, it probably has to do with human activity. And in fact, we know that we cannot explain that warming without the effect of increasing greenhouse gas concentrations. So I think because it became a symbol, an easy to understand symbol that really conveyed in a very understandable way the profound nature of the changes that we are causing in the climate of our planet, it became a target for the critics, those who don't want to believe in the scientific evidence, fossil fuel interests and the various groups that they fund, who have been doing their best to try to discredit the science of climate change because they don't want to see any regulation of carbon emissions. The hockey stick curve became a focal point of their attacks and their critiques. And I found myself, as a young scientist who never had any interest in being in the fray on the larger contentious political issue of climate change and what to do about it, I found myself at the center of that debate. And ultimately, I chose to embrace the opportunity that provided me to inform the dialogue about this very important problem. But it isn't what I signed up for when I first started out in science.
And some of this is discussed in your new book, The Madhouse Effect, where you talk about how all of the detractors used the ideas about science and trying to falsify science, but using it to try to deny what the facts were telling us. The peer review process, as you and I both know, isn't perfect, right? But what the denialists say when they are talking about the peer review process, they argue that there was sort of a groupthink thing going on. What do you say about something like that?
I'll quote one of the great science communicators of our day, Neil deGrasse Tyson, who has put it very bluntly. The great thing about science is it's true whether or not you believe it. And there are many who just don't want to believe what the science has to say. But what's so important about science, and Carl Sagan, perhaps the greatest science communicator in my lifetime anyways, talked about how science has this very important self-correcting process. If you're wrong, you will be found out. You will be shown to be wrong because there's too much of an incentive for other scientists to prove you wrong. The more extraordinary the claim you make, the more other scientists will be going after you, because if they can be the one to take down this very famous study, then that brings them much prominence as well. And so there's a real incentive for other scientists to try to disprove each other. That's the way you get ahead in science, is by not by just saying what we already know is correct. The way you get ahead in science, the way you get articles in journals like Nature and Science, is by providing us something new, showing us something different, proving that something that we thought was right is wrong. That's really where the incentive is. So the incentive in science is to be skeptical. And unfortunately, you have some individuals, and we do lampoon this in the book with I won't give away the joke here, but basically it's about Galileo and how climate change deniers like to compare themselves to Galileo. Well, you know, simply rejecting mainstream science doesn't make you a Galileo. It makes you a crank dressed up, dressing up like Galileo. Somebody wants to think of themselves as that. But real scientists are skeptics. All good scientists are skeptics. And we hold each other accountable for providing compelling evidence. And if a study is wrong, if it comes to the wrong conclusion, then the process of science will establish that it's wrong. That's the self-correcting machinery that comes through peer review, as you describe it, where scientists publish their results and other scientists can go after them. And eventually that leads to, you know, assessments where there is widespread consensus, because there are multiple lines of evidence from different directions that all lead to the same conclusion. When you reach that point, whether it's gravity, the theory of gravity, or climate change, human-caused climate change, when you reach that point where there are multiple lines of evidence from many different teams of scientists all pointing in the same direction, that's when you have a robust scientific understanding. And again, you know, with climate change, there's about as widespread a consensus based on many different lines of evidence from many, many thousands of different groups of scientists, about as strong evidence for human-caused climate change as there is for the theory of gravity.
Well, thank you so much for being with us again. Dr. Michael Mann, it's great to have you back with us.
It's always great to be with you. Thank you.
Professor Michael Mann is a climatologist and geophysicist, and he's the director of the Earth System Science Center at Pennsylvania State University. Dr. Mann was one of the lead authors of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, and has written a book called The Madhouse Effect. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.